The streets are empty. They must be hiding. The uprising is no surprise. Everyone in Warsaw had heard rumors of it happening, and everyone had a plan for when the day finally came, although no one knew exactly when it would. Bella and Jakub had been lucky to have Adam to rely on for updates through the underground. It could start any day, he said the weekend before. The home armies just waiting for the Red Army's approach. Axis powers, as reported in the Bulletin Informazione, were finally beginning to falter. Allied troops were breaking through Nazi defenses in Normandy, and there was talk of a massive Allied campaign in Italy. The Polish Home Army, Adam explained, hoped that with the Red Army at their backs, they could force the Germans out of their country's capital and, in turn, tip the scales toward an Allied victory in Europe. It sounded noble. Jakub and Adam had talked about sneaking their way into the Home Army. They wanted desperately to help. Bella is grateful now that Halina had convinced them otherwise. She too wanted nothing more than a liberated Poland. But the home army, she reminded them, didn't look favorably upon Jews, and not only that, the Poles were greatly outnumbered. Warsaw was still overrun with Germans. Look what happened, Halina prompted, after the ghetto uprising. And what if the Red Army doesn't cooperate? The home army was counting on Stalin's help, but he'd let them down before, Halina warned, begging Jakub and Adam to keep their wits about them. Please, she said. The underground needs you. There is more than one way to stand up to the enemy. Bella bears a hard right as she heads east on Wojtowska Boulevard, grateful to see river water ahead. As she nears, however, she slows. Where is the bridge? It's gone. Destroyed. A pile of sizzling iron and wide open water in its place. Picking up her pace, she veers north, hugging the curve of the Vistula, praying now for a bridge that's intact. 10 blocks later, her lungs on fire and her blouse saturated with sweat, she is relieved to find the Toruński Bridge still standing. The sky, however, is now crawling with Junkers. Ignoring them, along with the searing pain in her chest, the burning in her quadriceps, the voice inside her screaming to find a ditch somewhere and take cover, she runs as hard as she can. Halfway across the bridge, a dozen men appear. They rush toward her with frantic, loping strides. Bella's legs go numb until she realizes from their attire that they are Poles, civilians. Several have rifles slung around their necks. Others carry pitchforks and shovels. A few grip butcher knives. They gallop in her direction yelling, but Bella is too exhausted, her breath too loud to make out the words. It isn't until their paths nearly intersect that she realizes the men are yelling at her. You're running the wrong way, they roar, holding their weapons over their heads like warriors. Come fight with us, for Poland and for victory. Bella shakes her head as she sprints by, watching the ground to keep her balance. She doesn't look up until she reaches Jakub's door. It's their 8th day in hiding. The bombing hasn't stopped. Bella and Jakub agonize incessantly about whether the others, Halina, Adam, Mila, Franka and her family, have found a safe place to take cover, about what Warsaw will look like when the bombing finally lets up. They share the basement with a couple who had arrived toting an 18-month-old child, a hay bale, and to Jakub and Bella's amazement, a dairy cow. It took some work, but they'd finally coaxed the recalcitrant animal down the stairs to the basement. The cow smells. There's nothing to do but scoop her manure into a pile in the corner. But her udders are always full. Twice a day, fresh milk is carried in a bucket upstairs to boil over the stove. So it's suitable for the baby to drink, the mother of the toddler had said, although Bella was convinced that fresh cow's milk wouldn't harm the child. She thought of protesting. Venturing upstairs was dangerous and downright foolish under the circumstances, but instead she held her tongue, not wanting to disturb the friendly dynamic of the group. Today it's Bella's turn to boil the milk. She checks her watch. It's been nearly 30 minutes since the last explosion. A lull. Jakob, standing with her at the foot of the stairs, nods. Be safe, he says. She returns the nod and makes her way up the staircase, bucket in hand, then hurries down the hallway to the kitchen. At the stove, she pours the milk into a saucepan, lights a match, and turns the black knob under the burner to ignite a flame. As the milk begins to simmer, she tiptoes to the window. Outside, the cityscape is surreal. One of every three buildings along Danushi Street is leveled. Others are still standing but missing their roofs, as if they'd been decapitated. She scans the sky and curses as a swarm of Luftwaffe planes buzzes into view. Damn it. The planes are small at first, but they inch closer, and as they do, they change course and disappear. Bella steps away from the window, wishing she could keep an eye on them. She listens intently, glaring at the milk, willing it to boil. After a moment, the drone of engines overhead grows louder. She can hear Jakob knocking the floor below with a broom handle, signaling for her to return to the basement. He must hear it too. And then, somewhere not so far away, a bomb drops and the room shakes, jostling the porcelain dishes on the shelves. Jakob knocks again, harder this time. She can hear him calling for her through the floorboards. Bella! Coming, she cries, cranking the stove's knob to the off position. Another bomb, this one closer, on the same block maybe. She should drop everything and run, but first, she decides, wrapping a towel around her hand, she will retrieve the milk. As she reaches for the handle of the saucepan, her ear catches something new. It sounds like a cat at first, like a deep feline whine. Forget the milk, she chides, dropping the dish towel as she turns, but she's too late. She's barely made it to the door when the window explodes. The kitchen goes black with soot, and Bella can feel herself being thrown off her feet. Her arms stroke the air helplessly, moving in slow motion as if swimming underwater, as if trying to escape a bad dream. Broken glass. Shrapnel. Dishes spill from shelves. Shatter. Bella lands hard and lies motionless on her stomach, cradling the back of her head with her hands, trying to breathe. But the air is thick with smoke and it's difficult. Another bomb falls, and the floor thrums beneath her. Jakob is yelling now, but his voice sounds muted, far away. With her eyes pinned shut, Bella gives her body a mental scan. She moves her fingers, her toes. Her extremities are there and they seem to work. But she's wet. Is she bleeding? She doesn't feel any pain. What's burning? Dazed, she pulls herself to a sit, coughing, and opens her eyes. The room is foggy. It's like she's looking at it through a pane of filthy glass. She blinks. As her world comes into focus, she notices what appears to be a plume of gray snaking toward the ceiling from the back of the stove. Bella freezes. Had she turned off the burner? She had, right? Yes, yes, it's off. She glances at the debris scattered across the floor. The slivers of window pane, broken dishes, splintered wood, a dozen large, mangled hunks of shrapnel. The saucepan lies on its side in a pool of milk amid the rubble. She looks down at her clothes. She is not bleeding. She is wet from the milk. Bella! Jakob cries, his voice rippling with fear. He is there suddenly, squatting next to her, his hands on her shoulders, her cheeks. Bella, are you okay? Bella can hear him, but only faintly. She nods. Yes, I'm okay, she mumbles. He helps her to her feet. Something smells as if it's burning. The stove? Jakob asks. It has begun to hiss. It's off. Let's get out of here. Bella's legs teeter beneath her like stilts. Jakob helps her up and throws her arm over his shoulder, half carrying her back to the basement stairs. Are you sure you're okay? I thought, it's okay, love. I'm all right.
October 17, 1944. Warsaw must completely disappear from the surface of the earth and serve only as a transport station for the Wehrmacht. No stone can remain standing. Every building must be razed to its foundation. SS Chief Heinrich Himmler, SS Officers Conference.
Chapter 49. Mila. Outside Warsaw, German-occupied Poland, late September 1944. Nearly 8 weeks have passed since the bombs began to fall on Warsaw in early August. When the first one dropped, Mila had considered borrowing a car to retrieve Felicia at the convent in Wolfzwawek, but she knew she would never get there, not alive at least. Warsaw was a giant battlefield. Everyone was in hiding. There were Germans stationed on the outskirts of the city, holed up in bunkers, waiting to pounce the second the Home Army showed a sign of weakness. To leave would be impossible. So instead, she fled to Halina's downtown apartment on Stavki Street, where she spent her days and nights huddled with her sister and Adam in the building's crawl space, listening in the dark as the city was decimated above them. Every week or so, a friend from the underground would bring a small parcel of food, a bit of news. None of it was promising. The Poles were outnumbered and greatly out-armored. 10,000 residents, apparently, had been executed in Wola, 7,000 in Old Town. Tens of thousands more were transported to death camps. Even the sick weren't spared. Nearly all of the patients at Wolski Hospital had been murdered. As the siege dragged on, the Home Army became desperate. Has Stalin sent reinforcements? Adam asked each time he received news from the underground. The answer was always no. No sign of help from the Russians. And so the bombing persisted, and little by little, Poland's one-time thriving capital slowly disappeared. After a week, a third of the city was razed, then a half, then two-thirds. Mila is a disaster, sickened by the distance between her and Felicia. She has no way of knowing if the bombs have reached Wolfzwawek, and she never thought to ask if the convent had a shelter. With little to eat and an even smaller appetite, her slacks had begun to hang low and loose around her waist. She is stuck. And with each passing day, she's counted 52 since she's been in hiding. She grows more frantic. Every few minutes, it seems, the ground shakes as another steel explosive plummets to the earth, shredding homes, shops, schools, churches, bridges, cars, and people in its wake. And there's nothing she can do but listen and wait. Chapter 50. Halina. Montelupich Prison, Krakow, German-occupied Poland, October 7th, 1944. Halina is jolted awake by the metallic click of a key in a lock and the grate of iron scraping cement as her cell door is wrenched open. She narrows her eye that isn't swollen shut.
Brzoza!
Betz spits at her.
Up! Now!
She stands slowly, breathing through the stabbing pain in her back. In the 4 days that she's been imprisoned, she's been questioned over a dozen times. With every interrogation, she's returned to the cell with more bruises, each a deeper shade of purple than the last. She is on the brink of giving up. But she knows she must swallow the pain, the humiliation, the blood dripping from her nose, her forehead, her upper lip. She mustn't break. She's smart enough to know that the ones who break don't return. And she refuses to take her last breath in this godforsaken jail. She cannot, will not, let the Gestapo win. Halina was incarcerated just days after General Burr waved his white flag, declaring the uprising in Warsaw over. In the end, Stalin's men stationed on the outskirts of the city never arrived. After 63 days of fighting, the Home Army was forced to surrender. On the 2nd of October, for the first time in 2 months, A hush came over the city. When Helena ventured outside, shell-shocked, filthy, and half-starved, Warsaw, still ablaze, was unrecognizable. Her building was one of only two still intact on Stavsky Street. The others had been obliterated. Some were shorn in half, exposing their insides in an alarming state of disarray. Toilets, headboards, porcelain, tea kettles, and parlor couches pushed up haphazardly against twisted metal and brick. But most were nothing more than shells, their insides hollowed out, gutted like fish. Helena had picked her way through the rampaged city to try to find Jakob and Franka, a nearly impossible task as many of the roads were impassable. She arrived at Franka's doorstep first, where she fell to her knees. The building was gone. Franka, her parents, and her brother were nowhere to be found. An hour later, when Helena finally reached Jakob's apartment, she discovered that his building, too, had been eviscerated. She nearly fainted when Jakob surfaced from the remains with Bella in tow. They were safe, but they were also starving. By then, Helena could barely think straight. Franka and her family were missing. She knew she couldn't leave Warsaw without trying to find them. But she, Adam, Jakob, and Bella were in trouble. They were hungry and broke, and soon it would be winter. Before the uprising, Helena's employer, Herr Den, had told her that he'd requested a transfer to Krakow. "If you need anything, find me at the bank in the city center at Reinek-Klepowski," he'd said. Helena had no other option but to call on him for help. Adam objected to the idea, of course, claiming that it wasn't safe for Helena to travel to Krakow alone. But Helena insisted. There was a pocket of the underground that was still functioning in Warsaw, and they needed Adam now more than ever. And there was also Mila, who was in panic to reach Felicia. "If you stay, you can help Mila find the way to Wrocław, and you can keep searching for Franka," Helena said. "Please, I'll be fine on my own." She would go and return straight away, she promised, with some money, enough to get them through the winter. Finally, Adam agreed. And so, after arranging an exchange with another young Jew, her coat for a sack of potatoes to feed the others while she was away, Helena left for Krakow. Her well-laid plan, however, came to an abrupt halt a day later at the Krakow train station, when, moments after disembarking, she was arrested. The Gestapo who pulled her in showed no interest in her story or in contacting Herr Den to validate it. "Then let me wire my husband," Helena said, making no attempt to mask her anger. Again, the Gestapo ignored her. Within an hour, she found herself being escorted by police car through Krakow Center to the city's infamous jail, Montelupich. As she passed through the prison's red brick entrance, she glanced up at the barbed wire and broken glass surrounding the building, and knew without a doubt she wouldn't be returning to Warsaw, at least not anytime soon, and that Adam would be a wreck.
"Brzoza!"
"Coming," Helena grunts. She steps over legs and arms as she limps toward the door. Of the nearly three dozen women who share the cell, surprisingly few are Jews, at least that she knows of. She's one of four, maybe five. Most of the incarcerated in Montelupich's women's ward seem to be thieves, smugglers, spies, members of various resistance organizations. Her offense, according to the Gestapo, is her faith, but she'll never admit it. Her religion will never be a crime. "Get your hands off me," she growls as Betz locks the cell door behind them and wrenches one of her arms behind her back, pushing her down the hallway in front of him.
"Shut up, Goldie."
At first, Helena thought her nickname was derived from her blonde hair. But she quickly realized it was born from the yellow stars the Jews in Europe were made to wear.
"I'm not a Jew." "That's not what your friend Pinkus says."
Helena's heart wallops her ribcage. Pinkus. How do they know his name? Pinkus, the Jewish boy with whom she'd bartered her coat before leaving Warsaw. Pinkus must have been caught and given up her name in the hopes that it would help him somehow. She curses his stupidity.
"I don't know a Pinkus." "Pinkus, The Jew who took your coat. He claims he knows you. Claims you're not who you say you are.
Pincus, you spineless shit. Why would the Jew turn in another Jew? Halina huffs.
It happens all the time.
Well, I told you, I don't know this person. He's lying. He'll tell you anything to save his own life.
In the windowless, blood-stained cell the Gestapo have designated for interrogation, she offers the same explanation, over and over again. This time to two brutes she recognizes from past interrogations, one by the gruesome scar over his eye, the other by his limp.
You gave him your coat, the one with the scar yells. If you are a Pole like you say, then why were you doing business with a Jew?
I didn't know he was a Jew, Halina postures. I hadn't eaten in weeks. He offered potatoes. What was I to do?
Suddenly she's off her feet, a fist lifting her up by her collar, slamming her ribs against the cell wall.
I didn't know he was a Jew, she wheezes. Crack!
Her forehead meets the wall.
Stop lying!
The pain is blinding. Halina's body is limp.
Don't you see, she spits. It's revenge. Jews are trying for revenge. On the Poles.
Another crack.
A trickle down her nose. The hot, acrid taste of blood.
You must not waver.
He swore on his mother's grave, one of the Gestapo hisses. What do you say to that?
The Jews hate us.
Whomp.
She speaks through her teeth, with one cheek stamped up against the wall. Always have. It's retribution.
Whap.
The bony, muted crunch of her jaw meeting the back of a hand.
Look at you! You look like a Jew!
Halina's breathing is wet, heavy.
Don't insult me. Look at you. At your women. Blunt. With blue eyes. Are they Jews?
Crack.
Again, her skull against the wall. Blood in her lashes now, burning her eyes.
Why should we believe you?
Why shouldn't you? My papers don't lie. And neither does my boss.
Herr Den.
Call him. He is at the bank at Rinek-Leparski. I've told you. I was en route to see him when you bastards arrested me.
This part of her story, of course, is true.
Forget about Den. He's of no use to us.
The one with the limp hisses.
Then why are my husband?
The only person of use to us is you, Goldie, the scar-faced one yells. You say you are Paul. Then recite the Lord's Prayer.
Halina shakes her head, feigning annoyance, and saying silent thanks for the fact that her parents had chosen to send her to Polish gymnasium rather than to one of Radom's Jewish schools.
This again. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
All right, enough.
Call my boss, Halina pleads, exhausted. He's the only card she has left to play, her last hope. She wonders if the Germans have even tried to reach him. Perhaps Herr Den got caught up in the uprising in Warsaw and never made it to Krakow. Or perhaps they've called and he's finally given up vouching for her. But he seemed so adamant.
Come to Krakow, find me. I will help.
She'd tried, and now she's here. It's been less than a week, and already her body is in ruins. She doesn't know how many more of these interrogations she can take. She's heard from one of the new arrivals in the women's ward that Warsaw is still smoldering. She worries constantly of Adam, who would have been out of his mind when she didn't return, of Mila, who could barely function when Halina left, and of Franka. But mostly, she worries about her parents. The Gurskys expected money once a month to keep her parents safe, and now they haven't received anything in nearly 2 months. Could she count on the goodness of the Gurskys for her parents' survival? She's seen their meager home. They can barely afford to keep themselves. Halina can't help but imagine it, Albert escorting her parents out of the cottage, unable to meet their eyes.
I'm sorry, I wish you could stay, but either you go, or we all starve.
Surely in time the Gurskys will presume her dead. The family will presume her dead.
I'm coming back to you, she says silently, part to herself and part to Adam and her parents, in case they are listening, as she's escorted finally back to her cell.
Chapter 51. Mila. Outside Warsaw, German-occupied Poland. October 1944. The drive to the convent takes twice as long as usual. Many of the streets are impassable, forcing Mila to veer off on painstakingly long detours. Everything that once looked familiar along the way is gone. The barrel factory in Josefina, the tannery in Muschenov, the scenery reduced to an endless patchwork of rubble. Mila leans forward, squinting through the windshield of the stolen B6. She and Adam had found the car lying on its side a block from Helena's apartment. It took six people to flip it back onto its wheels. Adam had helped her jump-start it. All four of its windows were missing, but it didn't matter. Its tank, in a stroke of good luck, was still a quarter full. It had just enough fuel to get her to and from the convent. She taps her thumbs nervously on the steering wheel, scanning the wreckage before her. She must be in the wrong place, Mila thinks. Has she made a wrong turn? She's barely slept in weeks. It's certainly possible she'd lost her way. The convent should be just there, ahead. She could swear it. And then her eye catches something black, a shard of slate jutting up out of the earth. Her stomach heaves as she recognizes it for the chalkboard it once was. She's in the right place. The convent is gone. Vanished. It's been blown to pieces. Without thinking, she climbs from the car, its engine still running, and sprints across the plot of land where she'd last seen her daughter, leaping over scattered bricks and mangled fence posts in the tall grass. At the sight of a miniature desk chair lying upside down, she crumples to her knees. Her mouth is gaping, but she is breathless, faint. And then her screams slice like knives through the October sky, growing more violent with each desperate inhale. Miss. Miss. Mila is being shaken by a young man. She can barely hear him even though he's knelt down beside her. Miss, he says. She feels the weight of a hand on her shoulder. Her throat is raw, her cheeks tear-stained, the voice in her head relentless. Look what you've done. You should have never left her here. Her heart throbs as if someone has driven a javelin through it. Mila looks up, blinks, a palm to her chest, another to her forehead. Someone, she realizes, has turned off the engine to the V6. There is a basement, the young man explains. I've been trying to reach them for days. My name is Timoteusz. My daughter Emilia is down there too. Yours is... Felicia, Mila whispers, her mind too frantic to remember that at the convent, her daughter went by Barbara. Come, help me, there could still be hope. Mila and Timoteusz take turns lifting rubble from the place where the convent once stood. You see, Timoteusz explains, pointing, this appears to be a stairwell. If we can clear it, perhaps we'll find a door to the bunker. They've been at work for nearly 2 hours when Timoteusz stops, kneels, and presses his head to the earth. I heard something. Did you hear it too? Mila drops to her knees, holding her breath as she listens. But after a few moments, she shakes her head. I don't hear anything. What did it sound like? Like a knock. Mila's pulse quickens. They stand and begin slinging rubble again, this time with a renewed sense of purpose, a thread of hope. And then, as Mila bends to reach for a block of cement, she freezes. There it is. A sound. Yes, a knock. coming from beneath her feet. "I hear it," she gasps. She places her face to the wreckage and yells as loudly as she can, "We hear you! We're here! We are coming for you!" Her cries are met by another knock, a muffled shout. Tears immediately spring to Mila's eyes. "It's them!" She half sobs, half laughs, and then reminds herself that a knock could mean anything. It could mean a single survivor. They work faster now, Mila brushing sweat and tears from her cheeks, Timoteusz breathing heavily, his eyebrows knit together in concentration. Their hands bleed, the muscles running the lengths of their spines spasm. When they break, they rest for a minute or two, no longer, making small talk to keep themselves from imagining the worst. "How old is Emilia?" Mila asks. 7. "And Felicia?" "She'll be 6 in November." Mila asks where Timoteusz is from, but skirts the subject of Emilia's mother in hopes that he won't ask about Felicia's father. They are halfway through clearing the stairwell when the sun disappears, which means they have another hour at most of light. They both know, though, that they won't leave until the stairwell is cleared. "I've brought the flashlight," Timoteusz says, as if reading Mila's thoughts. "We're pulling them out of there, tonight." There are stars overhead when they finally reach the bunker door. Mila had thought there would be more shouting, more communication with whoever had knocked earlier. But since they'd made initial contact, she's heard nothing, not a sound. And suddenly it's not the rubble or the dark, or the task of prying open the door that terrifies her, but the quiet. Surely whoever is inside can hear them now. So why the silence? She grips the flashlight with two shaking hands as she shines it on the door's handle, watching with her face half turned away as Timoteusz wrenches it open. "Are you all right?" Timoteusz asks. Mila isn't sure if she can move. "I think so," she whispers. Timoteusz takes her arm. "Come," he says, and they step together into the shadows. Mila glides a narrow beam of light a meter in front of her as they shuffle silently inside. At first, they see nothing but the cement floor, its cracks and dust illuminated in the glow of light. But then the beam catches what appear to be footprints, and a second later, Mila jumps at the sound of a voice, not far from them. She recognizes it as that of the Mother Superior. "We are here." Mila shines the flashlight in the direction of the voice. There, along the far wall of the bunker, she can begin to make out bodies, large and small. The smaller ones, for the most part, lay motionless. A few sit up, rub their eyes. "Run to them," Mila's heart screams. "Find her. She's just there. She has to be." But she can't. Her feet are fixed to the ground and her lungs reject the air, which suddenly smells of excrement and something else. Something horrible. Death, Mila realizes. It smells like death. Her thoughts come and go quickly. What if Felicia isn't there? What if she had been outdoors when the bombing began? Or what if she is there, but she's one of the ones not moving, too sick even to sit up, or worse? "Come." Timoteusz nudges her and she moves alongside him, unable to breathe. Someone coughs. They shuffle toward the Mother Superior, who remains sitting, apparently unable to stand. When they reach her, Mila runs the flashlight over the others. There are a dozen bodies at least. "Mother Superior," Mila whispers. "It is Mila Kurz, Felicia. I mean Barbara's mother, and Timoteusz." "Emilia's father," Timoteusz offers. Mila directs the light at herself and at Timoteusz for a moment. "The children, are they?" "Papa?" Soft, scared. A voice penetrates the darkness, and Timoteusz freezes. "Emilia." He drops to his knees in front of his daughter, who disappears in his arms. They are both crying. "I'm so sorry we couldn't reach you sooner," Mila whispers to the Mother Superior. How long have...
Mamushu. Felicia.
Mila tracks her light swiftly along the wall of bodies until finally it lands on her daughter. She blinks, swallowing back tears. Felicia is struggling to stand. Bathed in light, the sockets of her eyes appear far too pronounced in her small face. And even from afar, Mila can see that her neck and cheeks are badly blistered.
Felicia!
Mila presses the flashlight into the Mother Superior's hand and darts across the bunker floor.
My darling!
She kneels beside Felicia and scoops her up, cradling her with an arm under her neck and another under her legs. She weighs nothing. Her body is hot. Too hot, Mila realizes. Felicia is mumbling. Something hurts, she says, but she hasn't the words or the energy to explain what. Mila rocks her gently.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm here now, love.
Shh.
I'm right here. You're all right. You're going to be all right.
She recites the words over and over again, rocking her feverish daughter in her arms like an infant. Somewhere over her shoulder, she can hear someone speaking to her. Timoteus. His voice is soft but urgent. I know of a doctor in Warsaw. You need to get her to him, he says. Right away.
January 17, 1945. Soviet troops capture Warsaw. That same day, the Germans retreat from Krakow. January 18, 1945. With Allied forces approaching, Germany makes a last-ditch effort to evacuate Auschwitz and its surrounding camps. Some 60,000 prisoners are forced to set off on foot on what will later be coined a death march to the city of Wodzisław in southwestern Poland. Thousands are killed before the march, and over 15,000 die en route. Those remaining are loaded onto freight trains in Wodzisław and shipped to concentration camps in Germany. In the coming weeks and months, similar marches will take place from camps like Stutthof, Buchenwald, and Dachau.
Chapter 52. Halina. Montelupi Prison, Krakow, German-occupied Poland, January 20th, 1945. A shaft of iridescent light perforates her cell from a miniature barred window 3 meters overhead, illuminating a square of cement on the wall opposite her. Halina can tell from its position that it is late in the day. It will be dark soon. She closes her eyes, her lids heavy with exhaustion. She didn't sleep at all the night before. At first, she blamed her restlessness on the cold. Her blanket is threadbare, and her straw pallet does nothing to buffer the icy January chill that emanates from the floor. But even by the standards of Montelupi, the night had been a busy one. Every few minutes, it seemed, she was startled awake by the piercing screams of someone in a cell a floor above her, or by the sobs of a prisoner down the hallway. The misery is suffocating. It's as if at any moment it will envelop her. Halina's cellmates, who once numbered 32, have been whittled down to 12. The handful who were discovered to be Jews were taken months ago. Others come and disappear by the hour. Last week, a Polish woman arrived, accused of spying for the Home Army. 2 days later, she was hustled out from the cell before dawn. As the sun began to rise, Halina heard a scream and then the pop of gunfire. The woman never returned. Curled on her side with her hands between her knees, she teeters at the edge of sleep, half listening to the whispers of two inmates on pallets next to hers. "Something's happening," one of them says. "They're acting strange." "They are," the other agrees. "What does it mean?" Halina has noticed a change, too. The Germans are behaving differently. Some, like Betz, have vanished, which for her is a blessing. She hasn't been called into the interrogation room in weeks. The men who come to the door now to remove a prisoner or to drop off a tin of watery soup, in the brief instances that she sees them, seem rushed, distracted, nervous even. Her cellmates are right. Something is happening. There are rumors that the Germans are losing the war, that the Red Army is entering Warsaw. Could the rumors be true? Halina thinks incessantly of her parents in hiding, of Adam, Mila, Jakob, and Bella, presumably still in Warsaw, of Franka and her family. Has Adam been able to find them, she wonders? Will Warsaw soon be liberated? Will Krakow be next? The door slides open.
Brzoza!
Halina starts. She pushes herself to a seated position and then slowly to a stand, her joints stiff as she makes her way across the cell. The German at the door reeks of stale alcohol. He grips her elbow tightly as they walk the hallway, but instead of turning right toward the interrogation room, he pushes open a door to a stairwell, the same stairwell she descended nearly 4 months ago in October, when she was first escorted into the bowels of Montelupi's women's ward.
Rauf!
The German directs, releasing her elbow.
Up!
Halina uses the metal railing, gripping it tightly with each step, for fear that her legs might give out beneath her. At the top of the stairwell, she's escorted through another door, and then down a long hallway to an office with the name Hahn printed in black letters across an opaque glass door. Inside, the man behind the desk, Herr Hahn, Halina guesses, wears a uniform bearing the double lightning insignia of the Sicherheitspolizei. He nods, and in an instant, Halina is left standing, alone, shivering in the doorway.
Sit,
Hahn says in German, glancing at a wooden chair opposite his desk. His eyes are tired, his hair slightly disheveled. Halina lowers herself gently to sit at the edge of the chair. Her mind buckles as she contemplates how exactly the Gestapo plan to kill her, whether it will be quick, whether she will suffer, whether her family, if they are still alive, will ever learn of her fate. Hahn slides a piece of parchment across the desk.
Frau Brzoza, your discharge papers.
Halina stares at him for a moment, and then down at the parchment.
Frau Brzoza, it seems your arrest was invalid.
She looks up.
We have been trying to contact your boss, Herr Dan, for months. Turns out his bank was closed, but we finally found him, and he has stated that you are who you say you are.
Hahn laces his fingers into a tight ball.
It appears a mistake has been made.
Halina exhales. A smoldering rage crawls up her spine as she stares at the man opposite her. For 4 months, she's been locked up, starved, beaten. For 4 months, she's worried incessantly about her family. And now this? A half-hearted apology? She opens her mouth, furious, but the words don't come. Instead, she swallows. And as the relief washes over her, quelling her anger, she is dizzy. The room spins. For the first time in her life, she is speechless.
You are free to go, Hahn says. You can collect your belongings on your way out.
Halina blinks.
Do you understand? You are free to go.
She presses both hands into the arms of the chair and eases herself to a stand. Thank you, Halina whispers when her balance is in check. Thank you, she whispers, silently this time to Herr Den. He's done it again. Saved her life. She can't think of how she will ever repay him. She has nothing to give him. Somehow, someday, she will find a way. But first, she needs to contact Adam. Please, just let him be alive. Let my family be alive. At the prison office, Halina collects her purse and the clothes she'd arrived in, and steps into a washroom to change. Her blouse and skirt feel sumptuous against her skin, but her appearance is shocking. Oh my, she whispers when she catches a glimpse of her reflection in a mirror over the sink. Her eyes are bloodshot, the skin under them eggplant purple, The bruises over her cheekbones have faded to a dull green, but the gash above her right eyebrow, thick and scabbed black, with an angry red rash around it, is lurid. Her hair is disastrous. Leaning over the sink, she cups her palms together and splashes a few handfuls of water over her face. Finally, she digs a clip from her purse and combs a lock of blonde hair with her fingers a few times before pulling it over her forehead and pinning it to the side in an attempt to cover the laceration over her brow. Folding her tattered prison jumpsuit, she sets it on the floor, then rifles through her pocketbook, where, somewhat miraculously, she finds her watch and her wallet. The money, of course, which was intended for the Gurskys, is gone. But her false ID is there. Her work permit. A card with Den's information. And her stomach drops when she feels it still hidden in the soft lining of her purse. Adam's ID. His real ID. With his real name. Eichenwald. Halina and Adam had exchanged their old IDs at the start of the war, shortly after they were married. It was Adam's idea. "You never know when we might need them again," he'd said. "Until then, best not to give anyone a chance to find them on us." Halina had cut a slit in the lining of her purse and sewn Adam's ID into it. She didn't have time to remove it after her arrest and before turning over her purse. The Germans had missed it. Breathing relief for the oversight, Halina exits the prison as quickly as her swollen joints will allow her. Outside, the January cold slaps her hard in the face. Patches of snow and ice cover the cobblestone street. She'd arrived in early October, when the weather was still relatively mild, and she traded Pinkus her winter coat. Her lightweight trench is no match for the winter chill. She pulls her collar up to her chin and digs her hands into her pockets, squinting uncomfortably into the glare of the sun. Ignoring the wind slicing at her cheeks and the shooting pain behind her kneecaps, she walks briskly, determined to put as much space between her and Montelupic as she can, while she contemplates what to do next. At a street called Kamiena, she pauses at a newsstand, where she realizes for the first time since leaving the prison, she hasn't seen any Germans on the streets. She scans the papers, elated to read that the Soviets, just 3 days ago, had captured Warsaw, that the Nazis had begun to retreat from Krakow, that in France, the Germans were withdrawing from the Ardennes. These are good signs. Perhaps the rumors flying around Montelupic were true. Perhaps the war would soon be over. Halina peruses the small crowd of Poles gathered at the stand for someone who might be able to direct her to the address Herr Den had left her. Hahn had said the bank was closed, but maybe with a German retreat it's been reopened. They were able to find Herr Den after all. If he isn't there, she decides, she'll have to track down his home address. She'll reach him, thank him, promise to reimburse him, then ask for a loan. Just enough to pay for some food, and for her passage back to Warsaw, where she prays, she'll find her family intact. Chapter 53. Halina and Adam. Wilanów, Soviet-occupied Poland. February, 1945. "It's this one here on the left," Halina says, and Adam turns the Volkswagen down the narrow drive leading to the Gursky's home. "Thank you for coming," she adds. From behind the steering wheel, Adam glances at her and nods, "Of course." Halina rests a hand on Adam's knee, deeply thankful for the man at her side. She would never forget the day that she returned from Krakow to her apartment in Warsaw to find him waiting for her. Mila, Felicia, Jakub, and Bella were there too. The feeling of seeing them together, her siblings, was indescribable. Her euphoria vanished, however, when Adam told her he had no news of Franka and her family. They were still missing. His own parents and three siblings, two brothers and a sister with a two-year-old son, had disappeared too, not long after Halina left for Krakow. Adam had been trying desperately to find them, but without any luck, and Halina could sense how much this agonized him. She'd felt bad at first, asking him to come along with her to Vilanov, but she knew that he would never let her travel on her own, and that if she arrived to an empty house or to bad news from the Gurskys, she wouldn't have the strength to return to Warsaw alone. Adam slows the Volkswagen to a stop, and Halina peers at the Gursky's cottage through the dusty windshield. It looks tired, as if the war has given it a beating. There are a dozen shingles missing from the roof, and the white paint has begun to peel from the shutters like birch tree bark. Weeds grow in the spaces between the blue slate walkway leading to the door. Halina's stomach turns. The house looks abandoned. Adam said he wrote to the Gurskys twice over the winter to check up on them, promising to send money as soon as he could, but he never received a reply. Halina runs her fingers along the unsightly scar over her eyebrow, and then slips her hand into her pocket, where she's tucked an envelope of zloty, half of the sum Herr Den loaned her when she finally tracked him down in Krakow. It's been 7 months since she has been able to deliver the Gurskys their money, since she last saw her parents, and it is everything she can do, not to fear that the worst of her nightmares have come true. "Just be here," Halina whispers, wishing away the horrific scenarios her mind has become adept at concocting, that the Gurskys, destitute, had been forced to leave her parents at the train station to fend for themselves with their false IDs, that Marta's sister, nosing around, had discovered the false wall behind the bookcase and threatened to turn Albert in for harboring a Jew unless he got rid of them, that a neighbor had spotted her parents' laundry, suspiciously larger than the Gurskys, hanging to dry in the backyard, and reported the Gurskys to the Blue Police, that the Gestapo had made an unexpected visit and discovered her parents before they had a chance to slip into their hiding place. The possibilities were endless. Adam turns off the ignition. Halina takes a breath, exhales through a narrow part in her lips. "Ready?" Adam asks. Halina nods. She climbs out of the car and walks ahead, guiding Adam around to the back of the house. At the door, she turns, shakes her head. "I don't know if I can," she says. "You can," Adam says. "Would you like me to knock?" "Yes," Halina whispers. "Twice. Knock twice." As Adam reaches around her, Halina looks from the door to her feet, to a line of tiny black ants marching across the stone doorstep. Adam raps his knuckles twice against the door and then reaches for her hand. Halina holds her breath and listens. Somewhere behind her, a wood pigeon coos. A dog barks. Wind rustles the scale-like leaves of a cypress. And then finally, the sound of footsteps. If the steps belong to the Gurskys, their expressions will say it all, Halina realizes, staring now at the doorknob, waiting. Albert answers the door, thinner and grayer than when she'd seen him last. His eyebrows leap at the sight of her. "It's you," he says, and then claps a hand over his mouth, shaking his head in disbelief. "Halina," he says through his fingers. "We thought..." Halina forces herself to meet his gaze. She opens her mouth, but can't bring herself to speak. She hasn't the courage to ask him what she needs to know. She searches his eyes for an answer, but all she can read is his surprise at finding her at his doorstep. "Come, please," Albert says, waving them inside. "I've been so worried with the news from Warsaw. Such devastation. How on earth?" Adam introduces himself, and in an instant, they are enveloped in shadows as Albert closes the door behind them. "Here," Albert says, flipping on a lamp. "It's terribly dark in here." Blinking, Halina scours the den for a sign, any sign of her parents. but the room is just how she remembers it. The blue ceramic vase on the windowsill, the green paisley pattern adorning the armchair tucked into the corner, the Bible resting on a small oak side table beside the sofa. There is nothing out of the ordinary. She lets her eyes travel along the far wall to the bookshelf with the invisible wheels. Albert clears his throat.
Right, he says, making his way to the shelves.
Helena swallows. A flash of hope.
When I saw your car come up and didn't recognize it, Albert says, sliding the shelves gently away from the cedar-planked wall, I thought they'd better hide, just in case.
They'd better hide. Albert knocks on the wall in the place where the shelf used to be. Pan I pani kurz, he calls quietly. Halina's cheeks are suddenly warm. Her skin prickles in anticipation. Behind her, Adam rests his hands on her shoulders, leans in so his chin brushes her ear.
They're here, he whispers.
Beneath the floorboards, there is movement. Halina listens intently to the shuffle of bodies moving in her direction. The muffled sound of leather soles meeting wood, the click of a bolt sliding open. And then they emerge. First her father, then her mother, squinting as they climb, stooped at first, from the Gursky's crawl space into the brightly lit den. A strange sound escapes Nehuma's lips as she rights herself to find Halina before her. Albert steps aside as the women collapse into one another.
Halina, Saul whispers.
He wraps his arms around the union of his wife and daughter, closing his eyes as he holds them, his nose burrowed into the small space between the tops of their heads. They stand like this for a long moment, their bodies melded together as one, crying silently, until finally, mother, father, and daughter part, wiping their eyes. Saul seems surprised to see Adam.
Pan Kurz, Adam nods, smiling. He hasn't laid eyes on his now in-laws since before he and Helena were married.
Saul laughs, holds out a hand, and pulls Adam in for a hug.
Please, my son, he says, crow's feet flanking his eyes. You may call me Saul.
Part 3.
May 8, 1945. VE Day. Germany surrenders, and Allied victory is proclaimed in Europe.
Chapter 54. The Kurz Family. Wojcz, Poland, May 8, 1945. Adam tinkers with the radio's tuning dial, adjusting it until a voice crackles through its speakers. In a few minutes, an announcer says in Polish, we will translate a live broadcast from the White House in the United States. Please stay tuned. Helena slides the living room window open. Three stories below, the boulevard is empty. Everyone, it seems, has stepped inside to gather around the receivers, to listen for the news that Wojcz, that all of occupied Europe, and the world for that matter, has been awaiting for the better part of a decade. Helena's decision to bring the family to Wojcz was a practical one. They'd managed for a while in Warsaw, but the city, what was left of it, was unlivable. They'd discussed a move back to Radom, had even ventured back for a visit, and stayed the night with the Sobchaks, but they'd found that the apartment on Borshavska Street and her parents' shop were now occupied by Poles. Helena wasn't prepared for what it would feel like to be met at her old doorstep by strangers. Strangers who stared at her with stubborn frowns, who claimed that they had no intention of leaving, who had the nerve to believe that what once belonged to her family was now theirs. The encounter had infuriated Helena so much she'd flown into a rage. It was Adam who brought her back to her rational mind, reminding her that the war was not yet over, that they were still posing as Aryan, and an outburst would only draw dangerous attention. She had left Radom disheartened but determined to find a city where they could settle, at least until war's end.